recent Quinnipiac College poll suggests that Democratic candidate for governor Ed Fitzgerald is struggling to get his message heard by Ohioans. Good morning. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, subbing for Ann this week. 65% of the voters polled claim they don't know enough about Fitzgerald to form an opinion of him. A police report that surfaced last week was probably not the publicity Fitzgerald was hoping for. Police reportedly found him and a woman alone in his car in a parking lot at 4:30 a.m. 2 years ago. Fitzgerald admits he was there, that nothing inappropriate was going on, and that this is just a political attack from the Kasich campaign.
The Republican Party has been intimately involved in trying to spread this kind of personal attack about me. I have heard that they were on some kind of expedition to get negative information about me for more than a year, and this is the best they came up with.
Joining us now to discuss this story and other political news is a panel of reporters that cover Ohio politics. Mark Kovacs, State House reporter with the Youngstown Vindicator. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Jackie Borchardt, correspondent for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
Glad to be here.
Welcome. And Daryl Rowland, the public affairs editor of the Columbus Dispatch. Daryl, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
In listening to the soundbite, and I couldn't help but notice that over the weekend, this was a big story Friday, Saturday, but by Sunday it had pretty much disappeared off of most of the major media web pages, at least as far as being a prominent story. So does this story still have legs, do you think?
Yes, Stu, I was kind of surprised it disappeared so quickly. I was the unfortunate one, I guess, to go out on the campaign trail with Mr. Fitzgerald on Saturday to see how he was playing with the campaign stops he made, the ones I went to were in Northeast Ohio, in a little rural Union Hall east of Ravenna, and the Medina County Fair, where he stopped by the Democratic Party booth. Folks there were very supportive. So he's hanging on to the core, if you will, the hardliners. The bigger question is, what happens with the big picture? I also talked to John Green. He's a very well respected political scientist at the University of Akron. Who sorts of talks about the same thing. A lot of this, whether this has legs, depends a lot on the Fitzgerald campaign. First of all, was he telling the truth? And thus, do inconsistencies arise? Does he address those? Or does he say, I've talked about it once, I'm moving on? And it's the latter tactic he's taking first. So we'll see what sort of inconsistencies may or may not arise. And that'll drive this story in a large part.
Jackie, how about you? You cover that neck of the woods, as well as down here in the state capitol. What's your read on that?
I know, and I was on vacation actually on Friday when all this fun stuff happened, so I didn't get to have a direct hand in our pretty exhaustive coverage of it. I think there are still some unanswered questions that will surface as Fitzgerald continues to travel around the state from reporters, like as Daryl said, and also from the Republicans who did probably help push this to the surface. I think, Ed is absolutely correct to say that Republicans have been looking for dirt on him, but that's politics, and it's to be expected when you're running for the top executive in the state of Ohio. So I think it'll still linger, and I think it will also help feed the state Republican Party's push to get more information from Fitzgerald, specifically the key card data and all the data of comings and goings in his job as Cuyahoga County Executive.
Yeah, there's enough inconsistencies and questions about the story that I think it's going to continue to go. Part of the issue with the new weekend cycle was the Toledo water situation came up, and I think everybody shifted their focus to that in Ohio. 400,000 people not having drinking water is a big story, probably a bigger story than a gubernatorial candidate parked in a car early one morning 2 years ago. So at least for the weekend, it was done, and everybody shifted their focus over there. I don't think the story's over by any means.
I was struck by the fact that the Fitzgerald campaign responded to this very quickly. There didn't seem to be that much of a lingering going on about responding to this. Was that a smart play on his part as a candidate?
I think so. Yeah. And I think it shows that they've maybe learned a little bit from past mistakes. When he chose Eric Kearney, a state senator from the Cincinnati area, very well-respected senator on both sides of the aisle at the state house, but he had some past tax issues. And as those bubbled up to the surface in several different media reports, the campaign was not as forthcoming as they probably could have been. And that story went on for 2-3 weeks before, and even longer, I think it stretched out before he finally decided, Kearney finally decided to step aside. So I think that the immediate press conference that was called was probably a good move to try and head off that 2 or 3 week long story, because they don't need that right now. And we're in August now, so we're getting a lot closer.
Didn't they try something similar with Kearney, though, after there were so many questions that weren't being answered? They had that conference call that we were all on where,
they did.
Okay, I'm going to stay and answer all of your questions about this. You just keep asking, and I'm going to stay here and answer them. And it was a long conference call with a lot of numbers, and we asked a lot of questions. And I think maybe the campaign had hoped, okay, that was the end of it. We've addressed all this stuff. But it just brought up more questions and eventually led to him leaving the ticket.
Yes, Stu, as you know, as you mentioned before we came on the air, you know, we've both been around this game a day or two. It's kind of wishful thinking, and frankly, I'm sure frustrating to a candidate that stuff like this doesn't go away. You know, why aren't you satisfied? I told you I spent almost an hour. I answered every question, almost, that reporters had. I want to be done with it. I want to go back to what I want to talk about in the campaign trail. Unfortunately, in this day and age, for better or worse, it doesn't work that way. Again, Professor Green says they need to go through that pain of sort of letting it all hang out there. And yeah, you got to be a pinata maybe for a few days, but as long as you answer consistently and truthfully, you know, this will be a 3 or 4 day story. If you try stonewalling it and more inconsistencies pile up, that's not going to do you any good.
Reminder to our listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, you can dial us in at my goodness, I can't believe I said dial, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. In looking again at the Fitzgerald response, up to this point, he's been kind of the quiet candidate. He's been, you know, kind of, well, seems like a nice guy from up in the Cleveland area, but as the polls indicate, we don't really know a whole heck of a lot about him. Is this, in some way, is it possible for Fitzgerald to turn around the negative in the news that broke late last week and maybe even turn this around in terms of finally maybe getting a little recognition and getting voters to say, all right, well, yeah, he stumbled, but this guy, you know, came out swinging right from the moment the story broke.
Yeah, well, it ended up he broke the story. I mean, to your point earlier, of course, is my understanding he just got a call from a reporter asking about this. Obviously, the Republicans had already dug up this police report, even though the police told my colleague Joe Varden last year that it did not exist. Republican Governors Association had gotten it. The Fitzgerald campaign was called. They canceled 2 campaign stops, rescheduled it. Again, my colleague, Mr. Varden, found out what was going on and, you know, broke the story about what the deal was. So they were trying to preempt the entire story. And their line is that blame Republicans. This is the type of disgusting, dirty politics that people hate this day and age. So they're trying to turn back on the Republicans. Whether that works or not, I don't know. Because he really went, I mean, he said that over and over, and he almost went over the top. He's talking about potential crimes by the mayor and perhaps others in the Westlake, City Westlake, the Cleveland suburb where the car was parked. He's talking about possible collusion between the Republican Governors Association and Governor Kasich, which would be a violation of federal election law. So he's returning fire, but is he going over the top? I don't know. Again, that's something that still remains to be seen.
I wonder how much of that is the former federal prosecutor and FBI agent in him. So, you know, that could be part of it. That could be part of it, too. You know, and how do you think voters are going to react to this kind of back and forth? I mean, as Daryl suggested, this seems to be exactly the kind of thing that turns voters off and not on.
Yeah, the mudslinging and the negative campaign ads, it seems like, you know, voters don't like those and they get turned off to it. And luckily, we haven't gotten into that yet on our TVs here. But they work. They, you know, they voters remember them. And even though they may say that they don't like the dirty campaigning, it's still it brings it to their attention. It piques their interest and they're going to remember the names at least.
Yeah, people may say they don't want the dirt, but they're all reading the dirt and they're all aware of this story right now. So even if it was completely innocent and in line with the explanation we have, people are still going to read about it. And I thought it was interesting the line Fitzgerald had during the press conference. He said, you know, if somebody from my campaign had pursued this and done this, I would fire them on the spot, you know, essentially. And that's kind of the high road tact, and we'll see if that plays out for the rest of the campaign.
Let's get back to the Quinnipiac poll, because that really, at this stage in the campaign, you know, we're just entering August and the election's a couple of months away. The poll, of course, shows Fitzgerald gaining slightly but lacking in name recognition. What, in your opinion, does candidate Fitzgerald have to do to kind of turn things around? And is he even showing any more signs or showing any signs at all of becoming more aggressive aside from what happened Friday?
I think he needs to get on the airwaves more. And, you know, we've been talking about that for months, that that's been a big challenge for the campaign due to lack of funds raised because it's expensive. But that is a very good way to get some name recognition. The campaign has been pretty aggressive in seeking earned media and traveling the state and holding press conferences and trying to get into the local newspapers and on local TV stations. But there's something to be said about having paying for your own message exactly the way that you want it and putting it right in front of voters' faces.
Mark?
It's interesting that he hasn't gained more. You know, if you look back at the Quinnipiac polls over the past year or so, he's right back where he started. He started around 76. He's down to about 65. Maybe being in the state house all the time and we just hear about him all the time. You know, he talks about how he's been to every county and he's talking to people. And I'm just shocked that more people don't know who he is at this point. It seems like that would mean something.
Is this more than really, you know, maybe, you know, is this about maybe stepping out more aggressively on certain issues? He ran his first campaign ad a couple of weeks ago, in TV markets around the state. But it was just kind of a general, hi, how are you? You know, here's what I'm about type of ad. It wasn't really anything, you know, really pointed in any way. So is that a strategy that perhaps he needs to employ, Daryl?
Well, sure. As my colleagues here indicate, though, you know, TV's not cheap. He is so far behind Governor Kasich in terms of the money on hand. A lot of us discussed, you know, why is he going up in mid-July? And, you know, we thought it might be to, you know, bolster that name recognition and maybe to help his fundraising. Sometimes you have to spend money to get money. We have a crucial fundraising deadline this week, and we'll see what their latest contributions are. But he's, you know, right now he's not just down 12 points still. It's, if you look at the entirety of that poll, he's behind in every category. And he's behind in areas where Democrats usually do well. For instance, among female voters, the gender gap has been almost infamous for a couple of decades now in American politics. Ed Fitzgerald is losing among women, even though he's specifically appealed to women's issues or has attempted to. Is he in favor of people like me? Again, Democrats almost always win that sort of poll question. He is not. Governor Kasich is here. So it is really across the board at this time. To turn around, he needs something big. Now, Friday, maybe something big. We'll see if he can turn it around. You know, again, we all remember the Bill Clinton and the comeback kid in New Hampshire, but a lot of different dynamics going on, you know, with this situation.
Well, and if you look at that poll, there's still one-fifth of voters say they don't know enough about Kasich to form an opinion, and he's been our governor now for 3.5 years. So I think part of it is also that it is still, and being, you know, now that we're in August, we think, you know, we've been watching this for a year now. We think we're getting close, but in a lot of voters' minds, they're not going to make a decision until we get into October and November.
And hold that thought. We started to get into the issue of what potential liabilities Governor Kasich may have. But let's take a break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. And welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, subbing for Ann this week. Her voice didn't suddenly get lower, so it's just me. You can call in if you've got questions. We've got the reporter roundtable this morning, and we're talking politics in Ohio, and among other things. You can call in at 614-292-8513 or email us a question or a comment at allsides@wosu.org. And again, joining us on the panel this morning are Mark Kovac, the State House reporter for the Youngstown Vindicator, Jackie Borchert, the correspondent for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and Daryl Rowland, the public affairs editor of the Columbus Dispatch. And again, welcome. Thanks for joining us again. Jackie, you had talked a little bit about you know, Kasich's lack of recognition among a portion of the voters. Let's get into that a little bit. How is that possible with a sitting governor, 4 year? Just about to complete his first full term.
Yeah, and it's not like he's been completely silent here these last 3.5 years. There's been plenty of controversy and also plenty of things that he can stand up and tout and as good things that he's done for the state. I think it just reflects a larger national trend too of people just don't pay that much attention. There was another poll, I can't remember if it was Quinnipiac, but another poll within the last couple of days that looked at like congressional candidates and incumbents, and Rob Portman, who has been our senator now and is not a complete unknown name, still had a pretty also high have not heard enough is kind of what they say. High percentage of people who have not heard enough to form an opinion. So I think it just reflects that people aren't maybe thinking about politics as much as we are, but as much as others.
Well, step back from your state house reporter roles for a little bit, and maybe step into the shoes of a political party chairman or something like that. What do you do? If you're seeing this, I'm sure Democratic and Republican leaders, are seeing this as well. So what is this telling you about the public as a, from a political standpoint? If you're trying to get your party or your candidate recognized, then it's just not happening.
Well, if I'm a Republican chairman, I'm really happy actually, because my candidate's ahead and the clock is running. And people are going to start going to the polls, believe it or not, for early voting in just a hair over 2 months from right now. So we can say, well, it's too early, it's still August. Of course, people are thinking about getting their kids back to school, getting that last vacation in, all that good stuff. But, it's getting late in the game. And I don't want to sound self-righteous or anything, Stu, or come off the wrong way, but I think part of the problem may be the media as well. I mean, first of all, it's well known how journalism has shrunk. Certainly, those of us who work in the print medium, we have smaller staffs. There's less political coverage around. I don't know if anything's come forward to take that place, to fill that vacuum in terms of reporting. Again, I know I was out in communities that have their own, TV, radio stations, newspapers, and there were no local reporters that I knew over the weekend, the day after this big, major statewide story breaks. And the other thing is, I guess the emphasis, as long as we're doing the mea culpa, at Friday's press conference, kind of a salacious topic, if you will, the table was full. And there were reporters that I hadn't seen in months there covering this story. Well, I just wonder how many would have been there if that press conference was on its original topic, was about Fitzgerald and the FOP endorsement. Substantively, who knows what's more important, but it's sort of a two-way street as well. Ohioans had to pay attention a little bit more, and maybe, we in the media or whatever sources are going to get these filtered information out is going to step up to the plate a little bit as well.
But the Fraternal Order of Police endorsement, wasn't it announced the day before? I thought the endorsement was announced the day before. Yeah. And so they're on a tour the next day in three cities to announce it again. From a news standpoint, it's already been covered. Now, I plan to go, you know, to cover that, just that, at least to get the shaky video, if nothing else. But so I would have been there. But I think in general, if we're talking about average people on the street, the people I run into at church or in the store or whatever, they're pretty in tune with what's going on with the White House and with the federal government. And they're angry at congressmen and they're angry at Washington, D.C., not getting anything done. You ask them about what's going on at the state level, and they have no idea. They don't follow it. Maybe within the last month before an election, they're paying attention. But they're just not as in tune with state government. It's not as interesting to them for whatever reason.
I really find that surprising. I mean, especially given, you know, what's happened over the last 4 years, you know, both good and bad, you know, as you had indicated, you know, the things that that Governor Kasich has done. But yet on the negative side, he's antagonized labor. He's with Senate Bill 5. You know, we've recently had the whole debacle over the freeze in state energy standards. You know, that's got, you know, people who care about the environment upset. But yet we're not seeing this translate into, you know, any kind of numbers or anything substantial on the at least thus far on the polling side.
Take that Senate Bill 5 issue. I mean, you know, you have 10,000 people at the State House 1 year protesting, and everybody's angry about it. It falls, and I think Democrats are still trying to use that to say, look, Kasich was the governor of Senate Bill 5. He's against labor unions. You look at the Quinnipiac poll that came out last week. Something like 80% of people said Senate Bill 5. That stuff's still important to us. But a plurality said it's not going to affect how we vote in November. You know, that's telling as to where things stand on those kinds of issues.
And even more important on Senate Bill 5, I think, is you think of the repeal effort. They had close to 1 million signatures. Well, that's like 1 out of 7, 1 out of every 8 registered Ohio voters signed that petition to put that on the ballot 3 years ago.
Well, and indeed, voters repealed the
and crushed it in the poll. So you've got that. Again, however you feel on this, plus or minus, state government affects your life. We're talking about billions of dollars, literally, in tax cuts that have happened. Again, for better or worse, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in cutbacks to schools and to local governments. I'm not sure why folks would not be paying attention to what comes out of the State House. You know, abortion rules, red light cameras. Gun
I think they
rights.
Care about red
you know,
light cameras.
You name it.
that may be the one issue that I get calls about all the time. Like, what is happening with this? But I never get calls on. So, what's the state of the income tax cut they were talking about last year?
Well,
so,
and that gives us a good segue into the next topic because as has been widely reported over statewide media, and we should say that the water use ban in the Toledo area, Northwest Ohio, has just been lifted, but that was a major story over the weekend, and you know the whole issue of water quality, whether it's in Lake Erie or smaller lakes here in Ohio or rivers, I mean again, here's another issue that you think people would be particularly upset about, but you know, so far the only consternation seems to be, you know, if you live in the Toledo area, mm-hmm. There's people talking about it on Facebook here and in and around, but it's still it's still an issue that doesn't seem to certainly hasn't come up in the governor's race.
Well, and that's that's an effect, Stu, possibly of a cause of state government inaction, at least arguably so. It seems like at least we should have that discussion. Has the state done enough to keep algae out of Lake Erie? I have talked to members of the Ohio EPA. They don't want their names used, but they talk about how difficult it is to regulate the point source pollution, you know, your treatment plants. That's hard enough. But what they call big ag, and we all love family farmers, but in Northwest Ohio, it's a lot of big agriculture as well. Regulating that runoff has just been pretty much nil. And I think most people agree, especially with the heavy rains in recent years in Northwest Ohio that's washed into the Maumee watershed, which is one of the biggest watersheds in this part of the country. And guess what? That gets in the lake. Algae says, ooh, phosphorus. Ooh, food. We're growing. That's what happens. So yeah, now everyone's upset, and we're spending millions and millions of dollars to fix the problem. But could there have been some prevention? So frankly, this would be another test for the media in this state and frankly, environmental government groups. Let's examine this. Should something have been done, or can we do something in the future?
Toledo City Councilman Larry Sykes is quoted in this morning's Toledo Blade as saying public officials who were ambivalent about environmental issues have been served a wake-up call. Do you think so? Are you seeing that possibility happening? Translating into action here, either legislatively or administratively?
I think definitely legislatively we'll see some action on this. I mean, state lawmakers have had many chances in the past couple of years to take up this issue, and they've been very reluctant to impose mandates on the agricultural community, which is responsible for much of this, of the runoff that ends up in the water supply. And earlier this year, they did pass a law or enact a law that would require some farmers to undergo training on how to best manage the fertilizer issue. But there's no mandate there. There's no big funding to solve the problem. There is a state commission, a task force, that is continuing to look at this issue. And when they released their Phase 2 report last year, their big recommendation was we need to reduce the runoff by 40%. But there were no ideas for how to actually make that get to that point.
Mark, you see this? Generating some action at the legislative level?
I don't know about action. Well, it should, but I think it's going to generate some debate in the governor's race, because Ed Fitzgerald now has an issue. He can flash photos of, the pea soup water, looking water from Toledo. And I'm already seeing pictures on Twitter of Grand Lake St. Mary's, which the administration has said we're dealing with, that look just as bad. I think they, if the Democrats are smart, they're going to come out and say, look, the governor hasn't done enough for this. He's not putting the money toward dealing with the algae issues. He's not willing to put the regulations in place to deal with runoff. You know, it could become a big issue, and people in Toledo, some of whom may have been spending a lot of money on bottled water, are not going to be very happy when they hear that.
Darryl, it's been discussed here this morning that people get, and Mark had said it earlier, that people are upset with Washington, they're upset with Congress, they're saying this is a do-nothing Congress, and yet nobody really seems to be upset about what's happening at the state level. Is this enough of an issue, since it affected so many people? I mean, the estimate was about 500,000 residents of Toledo and Northwest Ohio that were told they could not only not drink the water, but they couldn't bathe in it, they couldn't brush their teeth, they couldn't feed their pets. As Mark said, there was a huge run on bottled water. National Guard brings in tankers. Is this enough to get people starting to ask here in Ohio about their own state legislature, hey, what have you guys been doing for the last decade?
That's probably the question of the day, and that's to the point about the Kasich administration. You could probably point the finger of inaction, but you wouldn't stop there. You would go back, to lots of administrations, both Democrat and Republican in this state, for at least relative inaction. I would observe. It's a great question. And again, it's almost like the Fitzgerald story. Is this sort of problem's over, move on? We're such an ADD society. The news cycle, good grief, it's probably gone on to three different topics just since we've been on the air, Stu, post-Toledo. But we'll see. I mean, is there going to be enough substantive discussion, examination of this issue to get to the bottom of, let's hopefully put politics aside and analyze this. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the Quinnipiac poll, you look at the number of folks who are satisfied with the way things are going in Ohio, it is relatively high. And I think it's tied for the highest since they began polling in Ohio 8 years ago. And it's like the coach of the team. You get a lot of blame when you win. When you lose, you get credit when you win. Right now, a lot of people are saying, yeah, we're not out of the woods, but the arrow's pointing up in Ohio, and who's going to get the credit for that? Governor John Kasich.
I read an interesting quote from somebody, and I'm ashamed to think I can't think of where it came from, but I believe it was in the Cleveland Plain Dealer this morning, talking about people starting to hoard water in Northeast Ohio, well away from Toledo, but just on the possibility that this, you know, that if this algae bloom gets worse, and they're saying that this was a very early bloom that essentially, you know, carries that potential, because normally it gets worse into September, you know, in through the month of September. You know, what do you think? I mean, do you think this is gonna kind of get people to say, hey, wait a minute, what is our state government doing or not doing? And if not, why not?
I think it will be enough to pique interest across the state. I think this is one of those issues that has been an issue for a long time to the people who experience it firsthand. And now we have, you know, 400,000 people in Northwest Ohio experiencing it firsthand. It's been on the story's been on the national news. It's spread around the state so that I've even heard people in Columbus were stocking up on their water, which you don't need to do if you're listening in Columbus. And you also don't need to do that in Northeast Ohio either. Officials there have said that what has happened in Toledo is not going to happen up there because they get it from their water from a different basin. But I do think that maybe this is the straw that breaks the camel's back and actually makes, you know, takes the issue beyond a task force and an annual report, but really turns it into a statewide concern.
Lawmakers, I think the Ohio Senate has said they were going to have some committee hearings in either September or late August or something. So we should see a few lawmakers down at the State House. We'll see some members of the House talk in Common Core in a couple of weeks here. But perhaps this is a big enough issue that they'll decide to introduce some legislation and try to move it quickly then. Who knows?
And Stu, we should remember that the Columbus was affected just a year ago. Now, it wasn't toxic, but if you drank Columbus water that came from Hoover Reservoir, that was pretty crappy, and that was because algae had gotten in there. So
smelled bad and tasted bad.
Yeah, but now the city of Columbus is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to fix that. So yeah, that was gross, but that didn't hurt you. You imagine if it's gross and is toxic to even, you know, to even get a little bit drinking, and boiling makes it worse. First I've ever heard of something like that.
yeah. Well, and they said this is the same type of mitotoxin that caused, I think, something like 57 deaths in a similar situation, I think, in South America, a few years ago. Then, you know, this wasn't just something that's going to, you know, that's going to upset your stomach. This was something that potentially could kill you. So it's really, really kind of surprising we don't see the backlash, if you will, on something like this. We're going to take a break here. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Stu Nicholson, and joining us this morning for the reporter roundtable is Mark Kovac, the State House reporter for the Youngstown Vindicator. Jackie Borchardt is a correspondent for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and Daryl Rowland, the public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Again, thanks for joining us. We've had kind of a fun first two thirds of the hour, I guess. Let's switch gears majorly here. The first TV ad advocating for allowing same-sex marriage in Ohio aired this past week, making quite a few headlines in statewide media. Did you all get a chance to see that ad when it ran? I'm curious your thoughts. How was this for a first volley in a fundraising campaign to change Ohio's law, even though there's no actual legislation, you know, up on the hopper yet?
Well, this is an effort from the Why Marriage Matters campaign, which is a coalition. It's an education campaign from Equality Ohio, which is a state organization that was formed back in 2004 when Ohio voters voted overwhelmingly to ban same-sex marriage in Ohio. And some national groups have also supported this effort. And they've said kind of all along that their goal is to have the discussions first before thinking about putting an issue on the ballot to repeal it, or pushing some other type of action. They feel that the education piece needs to come first, and that starts by Ohioans having discussions about same-sex marriage in the state with their neighbors and their friends who are gay. And so this ad, I feel, was a pretty good introduction to that effort.
Daryl, what did you think when you saw it?
My first thought, I'm a political guy. I'm thinking, they've got a lot of money. I mean, this is an ad that's...
it was very well produced, very...
Oh, it was, yeah. Sure. And the production qualities, and they chose, if you will, what were probably perceived as two less threatening a gay couple, if you will, two older gentlemen. Mm-hmm. But it's almost 2 years until the filing deadline for 2016, which is their stated intent. And I think this is one of the dynamics. There was a bit of a power struggle, if you will, between the state and national groups advocating this. The Nationals won, which is one reason we're not voting on it this year, but we're going to vote on it in a couple of years if it gets that far. But I think this is why the Nationals won, because they have the big bucks, if you will. And, you know, this is portrayed sometimes as a civil rights issue or this struggling shoestring outfit. This is obviously a well-funded organization this time around. In sharp contrast, probably, to 2004 that Jackie alluded to, when it was probably the other way around. So, yeah, I thought the money is there, and this will be an amazing campaign. I also wondered why they're doing it now. The Sixth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is holding a hearing of five cases this week. And it's like, is this an attempt to soften the ground of public opinion, which, of course, we know never, of course, influences judges because they just decide it's strictly in the Constitution, right? Right. So that's why things have changed so much in the last few years.
Well, and this is going to be a case at the federal level too, and which one would think would be maybe be a little bit less, less concerned with existing public opinion or not, than perhaps if this was a state court and there was actual legislation before the, before the General Assembly. The question that came to my mind when I first saw the ad was, who's the target audience here? And I'm curious, what do you think? I mean, who seeing that ad, and it was very well produced. The ad, as Daryl talked about, showed two older gentlemen who had to go to New York to get married after many years of a committed relationship, and it was good production values, as you said. But who's the target audience? Who is this being aimed at? The Ohio General Assembly? I wonder. What do you think?
I took it as it being aimed at Ohio straight people, that saying, "See, look at these two. Here's a they're a bit old for children, but poster children, if you will, poster grandparents, perhaps, for the gay marriage case. Say these guys, they're not threatening. See how sweet their story is. See them affectionately touching each other. No harm, no foul. Well, that's 62% of Ohioans. You need to." Look at this cute older couple, and, gay marriage isn't that bad.
Well, the polling shows that the majority of younger voters, 18 to 34, don't see this as that it should be an issue. They think that same-sex marriage should be allowed across the country, everywhere. They don't have a problem with it. They approve of it. They support it. They would vote for it if we, had it on a ballot today. The problem demographic is when you get into your older populations, which is also your more reliable voters, especially if they were to go this year, that would be true. But in 2016, they're also going to, turn out to vote as well. So I believe this ad was targeted more toward that group of voters, the ones who maybe it's also shown that the younger group that supports this more than other groups. It does so in part because they know people who are gay, and they have friends and family members, or they're gay themselves, and it's a very personal issue for them, where older generations may not have ever met someone who's been openly gay. And so this ad is Ellen was saying, or I'm sorry, not Ellen, Daryl was saying, it's people you could see as your grandfathers or your uncles or your neighbors, very relatable people who could be living, you know, right down your street. And that is, as polling has shown, is very important to changing people's opinions on the issue.
It's going to be a very interesting 2016. If they've got money to spend like this now, I can't imagine how ugly that fight's going to be in 2 years, because I don't know that either side is going to give ground on that issue. Just the ads in a presidential year, it's going to be a very busy year for reporters, I think.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the big question is, will it ever get there, or will the courts decide it first? We'll have a federal appeals court decision one way or another out of Ohio on five cases, two of them from Ohio. After the hearing this week, this decision probably won't come for several weeks, but that makes that ripe. That makes all five of those cases presumably ripe for the U.S. Supreme Court, and they're making their way up from other states too. And so far, the side favoring gay marriage has won all the court cases since the Supreme Court last spoke on this.
And another thing that this ad shows that Daryl kind of hinted at is that these national groups see that Ohio is a winnable state. For a while, it was a very state-based effort to put an issue on the ballot to repeal the ban. And when you looked to the national organizations, they listed Ohio as one they were interested in, but they weren't committing large sums of money. So this shows that Ohio has maybe moved up a little bit on the list of battleground states where they feel they have a good shot of winning.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you'd like to call in, our number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's switch gears again here. Fair housing advocates were almost immediately up in arms over State Senator Bill Sight's bill that would lower penalties on landlords who discriminate and make it tougher for fair housing groups to recover the damages. Fair housing advocates are saying that the bill, if passed, would all but make the current law unenforceable by the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. Is that a fair assessment? Is it that dire of a change?
Well, that's the point of contention still, and opponents of that legislation also say this is going to cost us with the feds, that with Ohio weakening its laws, that it will give more power to landlords, too much so in the eyes of the federal government, and we'll lose some federal money because of that. Now, again, that's just what one side is saying. I don't know if they're right or wrong, to be real honest with you.
See, this is an issue that might come up in the campaign, potentially, if Senator Seitz pushes this through, or if it gets into committee.
Well, it won't be pushed through before the election.
Yeah.
I don't think it is as an issue appeals to as wide a swath of voters to make it a big issue in the election, especially because the groups that are concerned are advocates for the poor, and typically, they're not the group of this is terrible to say, but they're not the group of voters that politicians are necessarily interested in appeasing when they're running campaigns.
I was struck by the fact that when they were in some of the media coverage that covered this story, that Senator Seitz, who's usually pretty quick with a reply or a quote, declined to comment about his bill or any of the charges being made by housing advocates. What do you think of that?
It's telling that advocates are already jumping on this issue, and they must know something about what's going on behind the scenes. And I think it's something to keep a close eye on during lame duck, among other issues.
Several issues.
Yes.
There will be a lot.
Yes.
Well, Senator Seitz has, told my colleague Jim Siegel that he thinks we have an environment that discriminates against landlords. Apparently, groups use these quote unquote testers, and I guess he views that as sort of a gotcha, if you will, or almost an entrapment where, I'm not really trying to rent a place from you, so to speak, but I go out and see if you discriminate against me. That's basically what is at issue here in this legislation, I understand.
Yeah, but that's very similar to a lot of law enforcement stings,
right?
In general. So, and yet you don't see legislation aimed at that.
That is quite true. So we'll see what happens.
Well, sometimes you do, but it's from the side of the aisle that can't get anything through at the moment.
And I think, Mark, it was you that had mentioned that one of the things that is going to be coming up in the legislature is the introduction of a bill to replace Common Core. We had a pretty lengthy show on this last week, and what a lot of the advocates for Common Core seem to be pointing out is that they're hearing criticism, but they're not hearing anybody coming up with a better idea, least of all the people pushing legislation in the General Assembly.
And they're also saying that all these schools have already invested in this Common Core curriculum. They're already, you know, implementing it this fall to come through halfway through the school year and say, okay, we're going to a different set of standards, you know, would be disastrous in some people's minds and costly.
Most schools have been implementing them over the last couple of years in preparation to be tested on, according to them, next spring on the state tests. And, you know, the state legislature did make some moves to kind of address some of these concerns. The first being that they're going to have another group available to really, really dig into specific concerns about the standards. And they put some measures in there where they can dial back if necessary. And the lawmakers who worked on that felt that that was an adequate way to deal with the concerns that now in 2014 are surfacing, where back in 2009 and 2010, when they were being considered at length, were not brought up.
Well, I mean, I was with Governor Kasich a few weeks ago, and he got questioned about the Common Core. Now, he is a supporter of Common Core. The questioner talked about how history books had been revised to basically wipe out the Holocaust and Hitler and just little mention of George Washington. And Kasich, and frankly, nor did I had no idea what he was talking about. First of all, history is not one of the Common Core standards that Ohio has adopted. We've just done math and English/language arts. The second of all, this is not a federal mandate. Again, as the governor pointed out that day, the curriculum decisions are still made at the local level, your local school board, you know, your administrators. If you have a problem with it, go there. Mm-hmm.
Which makes me wonder, how the heck did this get turned into a federal conspiracy to take over our schools? I mean, that was something that critics of Common Core, you know, oh my gosh, it's this Washington's coming in to take over our schools. I mean, we got about 2 minutes left, but how the heck did that happen? You know, with a bill with a program that does have a lot of local control.
Right wing radio, I think, we're the first to really take this issue and turn it that way. And if you want to search the issue on the internet, there's all sorts of websites that will point you, that will lay out the conspiracies for you and who's connected to who and how and where the money's going. And it could be really convincing to someone who wasn't there or privy to the events as they were happening a couple years ago.
I think as it's being implemented, families started seeing some of the homework and stuff that their kids were bringing home. And a lot of it, some of the stuff I've seen during Common Core hearings down at the State House, you know, is weird and convoluted and awkward and doesn't make sense. And I think parents are seeing that and are like, what is this? Who put this into place? Well, the government put it in place, you know, and I mean, it seems like a logical, you know, okay, well, why is the government doing this? Why aren't my kids, you know, being forced to learn like I was forced to learn or whatever, not forced, we want to learn, right? So I think it becomes more real to people as it starts affecting them, and I think that's a big part of it too.
Well, we're nearing the end of the hour, and let me thank Daryl Rowland, the public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, Mark Kovac, who you just heard from the Youngstown Vindicator, and Jackie Borchardt, the correspondent for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks for joining us this morning. It's really been a pretty good, lively, broad-ranging hour, I would say. And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be coming back for the second hour, so stay with us.